Hello and a very warm welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and for this week's episode, we're going to be delving into the mind with special focus on the mental havoc wrought by the pandemic. Joining me to guide us on this journey is Professor John Markowitz, who's on the other side of the duck pond in New York City. Professor Markowitz obtained his medical degree from Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons in the Big Apple and completed his internship at New York Hospital, and in 1986 finished his residency at New York's Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical Center. He's board certified in psychiatry, and he's noted as one of America's top doctors. He practices, teaches, and conducts research at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Irving Medical Center and also has a private practice, and he's also affiliated with the New York Psychiatric Institute. John and I met quite recently, serving on the faculty of a conference about aviation safety, and I found him to be an erudite, accessible, and utterly charming fellow. And I also learned that John has five pet guinea pigs who live in two habitats in his kitchen. And in true Pavlovian fashion, on hearing his morning footsteps, they squeak with anticipation of breakfast. Well, I'm positively squeaking with anticipation of this conversation. John, Professor John Markowitz, welcome.
Thank you so much. That's a hard introduction to respond to. John.
Well, it has the beauty of being all true. I have to ask you: are the guinea pigs perhaps named for heroes from the world? Like, is there a Freud? Is there? what are the names of the guinea pigs?
No Freuds. They're not deep thinkers. They're very sweet, and I use them actually as. In talks about attachment, because they're very social creatures. Yeah. If you let one of them out of the cage, it will come back and rub noses with the other. Oh. They're very sweet.
That's adorable.
Their names are Albemarle, Bandit, Mr. Tufty, Belle, and Petunia, also known as Petit.
You know,
these are names from that the kids mostly gave them.
I was guessing that, or you know, I was thinking there's another very artistic side to you, John. I always like starting with something like this because, you know, it's really about seeing the man behind the mask, if you will. And I'll throw in my only connection to psychiatry. When I was at med school, I paid my way through med school by working as a milkman, a milk delivery driver in London. And on one of the routes that I used to drive, I would deliver milk to a chap named Clement Freud, who was famous for being famous in the UK. He was a trained chef who was very well known for promoting a brand of dog food. He would appear with this very hangdog bloodhound that sort of looked like him. And he was a relative of Sigmund Freud. So that's my link to psychiatry. John, thank you very much for being with us today. You're very much a New Yorker. Tell us about your ties to the city and what's kept you there, as I'm sure you must have been recruited by many centers globally.
I was born on the west side of Manhattan, and I've always lived there. I did my psychiatric residency at Columbia, which is on my medical school on the west side. I did my residency all the way on the east side of Manhattan. And worked there for a couple of decades. And now I'm back on the West Side again.
So you'd consider yourself an international traveler, having crossed. What's the old joke about Manhattan? It's an island 12 miles long and 4 hours wide because it takes so long to cross down.
During the pandemic, I've actually been bicycling to work, which has been very nice. But yes, you need to get out of New York sometimes for vacations because it can get to you, but I would miss the energy if I ever really left. So it's the city that never sleeps. And although for the past year is in something of a coma, it seems to be waking up again.
Right. Well, I was there recently. It was nice to see it starting to rise from its slumber. You received at least some of your training from the late Dr. Gerald Klerman, and I'm always interested in what inspired people. Again, reflecting on my own experiences of, you know, being a bit of a listless clueless, spotty youth, and there were people that really inspired me to into a particular area of medicine and particular ways to live my life. So I'm guessing he was a big influence on you. Tell us about him and others who affected your career direction and, frankly, the way you practice and live your life.
Yes, in psychiatry, probably in surgery too, we talk about the days of the giants when doctors were really supermen. And every field has its giants, and Jerry was certainly one of them. He started out studying pharmacotherapy, treating people with medications for depression. He studied the epidemiology of depression and other disorders. He was the head of ADAMHA, which is the name has since changed, but it was the Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Administration under President Jimmy Carter. And relatively late in his career, I mean, he was sort of a renaissance psychiatrist. He covered a lot of bases, community psychiatry, all kinds of things. Late in his career, he and his future wife teamed up to do a research study of medication where they said, you know what, we should really add a psychotherapy because most people in the community get psychotherapy, not just medication. So they made up a therapy based on what was known about interpersonal issues in depression. And it turned out to be a very potent treatment. And that became interpersonal psychotherapy. So for him, I don't know that that was such a big deal, but it has turned out to be a big deal for the field. And when he came to Cornell, when I was a resident and a junior faculty member, I was really privileged to have him as a mentor and a supervisor and teacher. So I learned the treatment from the master.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Well, you've mentioned interpersonal psychotherapy. I am clueless about all such things. truly. And, you know, clueless about, it seems like the older I get, the less I know about anything. I just sometimes think there must have been whole swathes of medical school that I just didn't hear about. But tell us about interpersonal psychotherapy. What is it and how do you do it and where does it work and so on and so forth?
It's a time-limited treatment. That means it usually takes about 12 weeks, which you prescribe the length in advance, once a week. And it's a treatment that focuses on the connection between how you're feeling and what's going on in your life, which is a very simple connection, but it makes a lot of sense for a lot of people. It's something you take for granted unless, let's say, you're depressed or anxious, in which case you kind of lose this. And you just feel like a bad person or an inadequate person or something like that. So we all know that if bad enough things happen to you, you feel bad. And if you're in a bad mood, you don't function so well, and so bad events follow. And interpersonal therapy really focuses on that connection between how you're feeling and what's happening in your life. Depression, for instance, can often start following the death of somebody close to you. That's a big life event. Being in a terrible relationship, where somebody who's supposed to be a support to you is not a support, but a problem. It's called a role dispute.
It's called a what dispute?
Role
dispute. A role dispute.
Role dispute. Okay. And any other major life change, like losing a job or getting married or getting divorced or falling ill with a medical illness, all of these things can trigger depression or panic attacks or other symptoms in vulnerable individuals. So we all have these things happen sooner or later, but some people have trouble handling them and develop psychiatric disorders. And you can imagine, like, COVID has provoked these feelings in a lot of people. People have died, and it's been hard to mourn them. People have had trouble with relationships because of the strictures of the lockdown. And people have had major life changes because of the pandemic. So strong events evoke strong feelings. And a lot of people just don't like having strong feelings, and particularly strong negative feelings like sadness or anger. And what they do is to try to suppress them and just think of themselves as people who have bad feelings. There's something the matter with them. Whereas, in fact, strong feelings may be appropriate to the situation. So what you do in IPT is you help the patient see that and to look at their feelings not necessarily as bad, but as actually useful social signals that tell you something about what's going on in your life and which you can use to change the things that are going on in your life. So this turns out to be a fairly simple, as psychotherapies go, very potent treatment that works for depression, for anxiety disorders, for eating disorders, for post-traumatic stress disorder. And it really comes down to helping people tolerate their own feelings and use them to say, this is what I would like to do, or this is what I would like not like to do. Don't do that. Stop doing that to me.
Is anger sometimes a part of a constituent of this panoply of feelings and reactions in these folks?
Sure. If you're in an uncomfortable relationship, it usually means somebody's doing things, behaving in a way you don't like. And it's really important to say, that's annoying to me. I need to say something about that. And to say to the other person, cut it out. Would you mind not doing that? If you can do that, you can change the other person's behavior. And the irritation goes away. That's what anger's for, in a way, to alert you to mistreatment or unfairness. And if you can't do that, if you keep the feeling in and say, who am I to complain? I'm just a bad person. Look at me full of complaints. Then you suffer a mistreatment from other people who may not even realize that you're upset. So anger is a good thing. It's a question of how you use it.
So is this therapy normally delivered by clinical psychologists, because you're a psychiatrist? Who would normally deliver this kind of therapy, John?
Any mental health professional can do it. It's certainly available in the UK, and I would imagine many of the people doing it are psychologists. Psychiatrists tend to be diverted to other things, and I think that's even truer in the UK than in America. But skilled nurses, social workers, psychologists. Lots of people can do this. In fact, in Africa, there are studies where people with a bachelor's degree without specific mental health training were able to do a form of IPT and help treat depression.
You know, someone very wise taught me the expression, and I didn't know what he meant by it at the first time of utterance. We seek the teeth that match our wounds. And what he explained to me was that something happens to us in life that we don't like. It's not a good outcome. It might be a bad romantic relationship, a bad business relationship, a bad experience in our childhood that we weren't able to fix and achieve an acceptable outcome. So we look for someone that mirrors that behavior and we try again. But if we've not been given the tools to deal with it, we're doomed to the same outcome. Does that resonate with you? Does that make sense, John?
Yes, I think so. I think this is what, going back to Freud, he called the repetition compulsion. And yes, we all have maladaptive patterns that we get into, and it's important to try to recognize them and change them.
Yeah, right. So, again, the lovely thing for me about dealing in this area is I know so little about it. I've mentioned on this podcast before someone very, very dear to me ended his life coming up on 3 years ago, actually, in 3 weeks, by abusing the drug ecstasy. And I know his parents will never be the same again, and I don't think I will. And I realized how little I knew about that space. And so much of what we have discussed and we're going to be discussing is so new to me. And this is basically a plea to anyone who's listening. This does affect all of us as healthcare professionals or just caring individuals to learn more about the way people feel and think and behave so that we can potentially intervene and get them to a professional like John. So that was just an advertisement for Professor Markowitz. So John, you're also interested in something called cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT and psychopharmacology, medications to treat psychiatric conditions, yes? And I recently learned a little bit about CBT and love to know your thoughts and where it would fit into your armamentarium together with the interpersonal therapy you've just described.
Yeah, first, John, I'm sorry to hear about that suicide. That's a terrible thing. And that's really the worst outcome of psychiatric illness. And it's preventable if you treat the underlying disorder. When people are really depressed, they're in a lot of pain, and it looks like it's going to last forever. And in fact, cognitive therapy is about having these kinds of hopeless thoughts that are so distressing, and they fit your mood so that you actually believe them, even though there may not be a lot of evidence for them. What you do in cognitive therapy is to help patients see that when, for instance, they're depressed, they have distorted negative thoughts. And because they're mood congruent thoughts, because they fit the mood, they're very believable. So somebody who's suicidal often feels, and Aaron Beck, who developed the therapy, called this the cognitive triad, three kinds of negative thoughts, which together are literally killers. The first is, I'm a loser, I'm a terrible person, I'm really bad, no one could possibly like me. My life is a disaster, and it's going to be a disaster. So really negative thoughts about oneself. Second, really negative thoughts about the oppression of the environment. Even if I were a capable individual, how could I deal with the pressures I face? The world is a terrible place. I just can't deal with it. It's overwhelming. So I'm weak, the world is toxic, and the third thought is, and it's never going to get any better. So if you're in a lot of pain, if you feel like a complete loser with no hope for things getting any better, and in an oppressive environment, why not kill yourself? That's the way people think when they're really down and suicidal, and it leads to the behavior. Unfortunately. So this is preventable. If you treat depression with interpersonal therapy, with cognitive therapy, with medication, with some combination, people get better. And really important to seek treatment if you're feeling like your feelings are out of control.
So describe where CBT fits in instead of interpersonal, where you would say, this patient needs CBT?
Well, look, to some degree, this is a matter of whose office you walk into. IPT and CBT, interpersonal therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, treat fundamentally the same disorders, and medication does too. So if you go see psychiatrist, you're more likely to be prescribed a medication, although good psychiatrists also do psychotherapy. If you go to see a psychologist, you're less likely to get medication. And at least in the US, you're more likely to get CBT because it's in all the training programs, which IPT isn't entirely. So partly it's luck of the draw. Whose office did you wander into? which is a problem in our field. The as far as which treatments work better for a given condition, we don't know that much. There have been comparative research trials comparing IPT to CBT to medication. And sometimes there's a difference. On average, they all work about equally well, but in certain circumstances, there may be a difference. So for instance, we did a study a long time ago on patients with depression in the context of HIV during the AIDS epidemic. And in that study, IPT, which focuses on negative life events, did better than CBT, which focuses on, you know, don't exaggerate your negative thoughts. But if you're 23 years old and you have no immune system left and you have a Kaposi sarcoma growing on your face and you see all the friends around you dying, saying don't catastrophize is a less strong argument. That's a circumstance where CBT maybe isn't such a good fit. And IPT, which says, well, of course you're depressed. Look at what's happening in your life. And now let's see what you can do about it, is a better approach.
So let's drill down into that project. That was funded by the National Institutes of Mental Health, as I recall, and it was psychotherapy for PTSD among the depressed spouses of returning veterans who'd served in the armed forces for our non-American audiences, and depressed HIV-positive patients, as you've suggested. I believe the goal there was to evaluate relative efficacy and mechanisms of psychotherapy, interpersonal psychotherapy, prolonged exposure, and relaxation therapy. Tell us a bit more about what your findings were about, because, you know, I'm sure that, again, I'm a bit of a Luddite as far as this. I don't understand the technology, if you will, or the lexicon. And I would love to have a better understanding of when which is used and why and what the data show.
Okay, Jonathan, you've mixed up actually a few different studies. So,
well, I told you I didn't understand anything. I'm totally confused.
Some of those are funded by the National Institute of Mental Health and some not. We're really grateful to the NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health, which has been the prime source of psychotherapy funding in the U.S. for what they did in the past. They are no longer interested, sadly, in any kind of clinical research. They just want to solve the brain, pure neuroscience. So even though we have a lot of clinical questions we'd like to answer, we no longer can rely on the major source of support in the U.S. But in the old days, they did fund studies. We did this study for HIV in the 1990s, depression in the context of HIV, where we compared IPT and CBT and medication. They all helped treat depression. And I should say that at that point, there was a real question. This is a long time ago, but that was a very scary and stigmatizing epidemic. And a lot of people thought at the time that anyone who was HIV positive would get and should get depressed, because you're going to die of this stigmatizing illness, sexually transmitted or drug transmitted, at a young age, and you ought to be depressed. So it turned out that's not true. It turned out that most people didn't get depressed. The people who did get depressed tended to have histories or family histories of depression. And all of our treatments worked, although some of them worked better than others. Medication and IPT worked better than CBT, which is not usually the case. But again, I think it's circumstantial because of the context in which the depression was taking place. We did another study then in the last big grant I got from the NIMH was in 2008, and we compared IPT to prolonged exposure, which is a kind of exposure therapy, the best tested one, to relaxation therapy, as you said, for individuals who had chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. So these are, were 110 people who had trauma of some kind, but really bad trauma, sexual assault, physical assault, child abuse, military trauma, all kinds of things. And they had had PTSD symptoms for about 14 years on average. And we gave them 14 weeks of treatment with either prolonged exposure, which we knew worked, it had been tested a lot, or relaxation therapy, which is an active control where you calm down your muscles and you watch your breathing and think pleasant thoughts and relax your body so you're not so tense. And that helped to a degree. And then IPT was not an exposure treatment. And is not, was according to the dogma of the time, was not supposed to work for PTSD. There was a longstanding idea that if you've been traumatized, what you need to do is to face your fears. So I'm sorry for the digression, but in PTSD, what happens is you go through something ghastly, something really terrible happens to you, and it's overwhelming, and you have overwhelming feelings about it. Seeing your buddy vaporized on the field in combat, or being held up at knife point with a knife to your throat and thinking you're going to die, or being abused for years as a child, or sexual abuse. These are terrible events that create terrible emotional responses, and people hate that emotion and suppress it. And try not to think about it and try not to feel it and go numb. And it doesn't work, because if you try not to think about pink elephants, what comes to mind is invariably pink elephants. So what you, and you start to avoid everything that reminds you of the trauma, which can be everything after a while. So I was in New York for the September 11th attacks, and for years after, to this day, I know what the color of the sky was. I remember images of the buildings burning downtown, which you could see from uptown. And a lot of people after that started to avoid lower Manhattan, tall buildings, airplanes, certain times of day, certain smells, certain patterns in the sky. Anything that reminded them of 9/11. What exposure therapy does is to make you face those cues, which initially makes you very nervous because you've been doing your best to avoid them. And if you can face those reminders of the trauma, after a while you say, oh, the trauma was awful. But the sky isn't dangerous. Tall buildings aren't dangerous. Airplanes aren't dangerous. Lower Manhattan is no longer dangerous. And if you face these fears one by one, starting with the easy ones and building up to the scarier ones, you habituate. You no longer feel so anxious about them. And your symptoms subside and you can resume normal life. So that's exposure therapy. It works, but it's really tough because you're asking people to do what they most fear, and they don't like to do that. And a lot of people, even though they know it works, refuse to do this therapy or drop out of this therapy.
It's sort of like vaccination and the immune system, isn't it? You're sort of presenting challenges to strengthen the immune system. You're sort of strengthening the your mentality. It makes sense to me.
Well, so what we did with interpersonal therapy was not make it an exposure therapy, but to make it a focused on the interpersonal consequences of having been traumatized. Basically, what does that do to your social life? What is it? What has been the consequence of the trauma? And people who have PTSD are very socially withdrawn. They don't trust anyone because they've had very bad experiences with the environment and with people. And we help patients get under the numbness of their feelings, again, to see, help them see that feelings mean something, that they tell you something about what's going on. And if, for example, you're angry at somebody, maybe it means that you don't trust them and you could bring it up. And if you bring it up, the person either says, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be bothering you, in which case, maybe you could trust them. And if they respond badly, maybe you can't trust them. So this helped people deal with interpersonal trust, which is a big deal in PTSD. And what we found in the study is that everybody in, not everybody, but equal numbers of people, it got better in IPT and in prolonged exposure. And both of those did better than the relaxation therapy, although that also worked. And so a non-exposure therapy, which isn't supposed to work for PTSD, worked just as well as the best tested exposure therapy. And it actually worked even better for patients who had concomitant depression or had had a sexual trauma. So we're kind of excited about that.
Well, I'm going to come back to PTSD in a minute, but I've got a pressing question because you've mentioned medication. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading the book Listening to Prozac by Peter Kramer that stirred up quite some... Now, I'm in England now, so we say controversy or controversy in America. I love that. I think it was Sherwin Newland, who I met years ago, who rather savaged it. Are we getting smarter about medications to address common conditions that psychiatrists would see and the role of drugs like Prozac?
I hope we're getting smarter. I think we're getting smarter. Peter Kramer wrote that book a long time ago, and it was, there have been a lot of changes in the field. There used to be a lot of stigma about depression, and that in our country, that's changed a lot, simply because celebrities came out and said, yeah, I've been depressed. Actresses like Brooke Shields and Tipper Gore, the wife of the vice president, and it's like, actually, this just happened with Naomi Osaka, the tennis champion who retired from the French Open, saying she had a history of depression. It's no longer such a big deal because people have said, of course I get depressed, and it's treatable. Part of that revolution, I think, was Prozac, or fluoxetine is the generic name. Peter Kramer wrote this book in after fluoxetine came out in the late 1980s, and it was a blockbuster drug for a couple of reasons. It's not that it was more effective than older antidepressants, but it was overall better tolerated. People had fewer side effects. And mainly it was popular because general practitioners were not afraid to prescribe it. It was easy to prescribe, whereas other older medicines you had to build up gradually and there were potentially more side effects. And so that was something psychiatrists did and a lot of other doctors did not. So Prozac made medication much more acceptable and accessible to the public. And Peter Kramer wrote a rather dull philosophical book about this, which was a bestseller because it had such a great title. And I'm not surprised that Sherwin Newland gave it a difficult review. I think it was hard to read. I don't know if you finished it, Jonathan. I
don't want to make cheap jokes, but I got depressed reading it. Yes.
And it was sort of a wrongheaded book, actually, because Peter Kramer said, I think Prozac changed the personalities of my patients who had not been getting better for a long time. And a lot of psychiatrists knew when he wrote this that it was wrong, that what fluoxetine does is to treat underlying, often chronic depression. And that is a new lease on life for a lot of people. They're calmer, they feel better, and it's almost like a personality change, but it isn't really a personality change. It's the relief of depression that's been there for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember a colleague of mine describing it like someone is in disguise and they take off a massive overcoat. They're still the same person. It's just the overcoat's gone. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned PTSD, and I said I had another pressing question. I recently chatted to a delightful gentleman, Dr. Eugene Lipov, who made the almost serendipitous observation that led to stellate ganglion block, which we've been using for a long time to treat hyperhidrosis, sweaty armpits and hands and pain and all sorts of things. And he's been using it to address symptoms of anxiety and PTSD with almost immediate effect. Have you had any experiences with this therapy? If not, that's fine. But I've just, you know, just spoke to the guy and I'd love to know if other people had heard of it. I hadn't.
I've heard of it. There is research on this, but it's really not my corner of the field. I don't have any immediate experience with the treatment, but it as you're suggesting, it makes a certain amount of sense. PTSD involves an overly excited sympathetic nervous system, so you're releasing a lot of adrenaline. You're in a state of physical tension and arousal, and you can't get out of it. And so blocking that system with a targeted injection of an anesthetic to the stellate ganglion in your neck is a way of calming things down. So in a way, it's like taking a beta blocker for anxiety, which also works to a degree. It may do some good, but I have to say, it seems a little invasive as a treatment. And the research I've read tends to show a decrement in symptoms, not a complete remission. So I think really treating PTSD tends to require a change in outlook, which is something psychotherapy is better at delivering than somatic treatments like stellate ganglion blocks or medication.
Well, talking about books, we've mentioned a rather dull book. I would imagine that yours is not. It's on order. I've not read it yet, but in April of this year, your book came out in the aftermath of the pandemic, Interpersonal Psychotherapy for Anxiety, Depression and PTSD, published by the Oxford University Press, bless their cotton socks. There are a number of fascinating elements to this book from what I've read. And again, I want to be completely honest. I'm a voracious reader and I'm looking forward to going to bed a little bit less dumb. First, talk to us about the shift to telemedicine for psychiatry over the course of this pandemic. Is it as good as in person? Certainly it's greener, less travel and so on, and maybe more time efficient for all concerned. So yeah, that's your first question inspired by your weighty tome.
Okay, I hope it's not too weighty. It's a slim volume and I hope it's not too boring either. Teletherapy has had one huge advantage in this last year and counting. It definitely provides easy access to care. It also provides a whole lot of distractions and it's not ideal. With the pandemic, we've really had no choice. It's not safe to see people in a confined office if either of you could be infectious and give the other COVID. So there's been a wholesale adoption of video therapy in place of in-person therapy. And some people love it. The evidence base for its use is really meager. It used to be sort of a niche treatment, teletherapy for like rural settings where there just were no mental health practitioners. And so the only way to connect would be teletherapy or nursing homes, things like that. And now it's the whole population being treated either over the phone or by video. And for video in particular, we don't know very much about it. So it's been a huge natural experiment. And it's the teletherapy works. People do get better. But there are a lot of distractions. You have to make sure your email's off. It's pretty clear to me sometimes patients are reading their email or, you know, there's somebody in the next room yelling. There are privacy issues. There are a million distractions. And it's harder to read people. There's something very important about being in the same room with somebody and seeing them and giving them your full attention. And you lose that on the 2D screen. It's hard for me sometimes to read. You don't see the whole body. You don't see the person's stance so much. You'd see a talking head. And it's very hard to read things like dissociation when people are suddenly go numb. That's hard to see in person. It's harder to see on the screen. So it's not great. I hope that as things calm down and return to normalcy or something approaching normalcy, that people go back to in-person therapy. But it's been impossible this past year. And under those circumstances, teletherapy has been wonderful.
Interesting. I know that a pediatrician friend of mine was saying she prefers it because she can see kids in their natural environment and they're not traumatized by coming to the office. But the points you make perfect sense. There's also a novel COVID-19 behavioral checklist of psychological risk factors. Can you tell us a bit about this? Again, you know, from the perspective of, you know, someone like me who doesn't have your nuanced view of the world.
I'm not sure this is so nuanced, but we were doing this in practice, and so I put it in the book. This is just four basic questions we've been asking patients since last March of 2020, which have to do with characteristic stressors of the COVID pandemic. The first is about fear of infection. How worried are you about getting COVID? What measures are you taking? And look, I mean, you should be somewhat worried about getting COVID, right? That's normal. It could kill you. It could hurt people around you. So a certain amount of anxiety is normative. And the question is, how much anxiety? At what point does anxiety as a helpful signal become a symptom and not helpful? And what you want to have some sense of what risks is somebody taking, what due to COVID? Are they taking no risks at all and never leaving the house? Are they being reckless? How are they handling things? So that's the first question. The second question had to do with how much has COVID upset the schedule of your life? We are all creatures of habit, and we live or have lived by regular schedules. People may hate their commutes, but they're familiar. And if you know you're going to work every day and doing the same things every day and coming home from work and having meals with your family, there's an order to that which people appreciate and find comfortable. And a lot of that's been disrupted by the pandemic and the lockdown. So if your day is jumbled, if you have no schedule, or if you don't have a regular schedule in the way you had, it can be disorienting and make you anxious. It can affect your sleep cycle, which is important to keep in balance. So that's the second thing. Fear of anxiety, of infection, fears about COVID, and how is your schedule balanced? What's COVID done to that? And the really big thing then is that the lockdown with physical distancing brings the risk of social distancing. And I know you're aware of that, Jonathan, because you brought it up in our previous meeting. Social supports are really, really, really important. If you are going through a crisis, it's really helpful to have someone you can talk to about it, to say, let me tell you what just happened to me. I'm having a terrible time. If you do that, you can handle your feelings, you can process the event, and you're more likely to get over it. If you can't do that, if you're cut off and isolated from other people, you hold in all your feelings and it's very uncomfortable. And for vulnerable individuals, that can contribute to developing depression or PTSD or anxiety disorders. So everyone's had changes to their social environment due to COVID. And either you may be too isolated living on your own, or you may be too covered with other people all crammed into the same house and driving each other crazy. But one way or another, your social life has likely been disrupted, and it's important to know about that. And mobilizing social support's one way to get through a crisis. The fourth category is, how much social media are you watching? How much time are you spending online on social media? To have some awareness of the news is important. So, you know, some time online is fine, but if you're spending hours and hours online, and in particular, it seems like more than 4 hours a day, and in particular, 4 hours a day on social media sites, that seems to be a risk factor for anxiety and depression. So this is something we check on too.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. I will be getting the book. I will be reading it. I will doubtless be calling you and saying, can we have you back on? Because I didn't understand these 10 things. But everything you say makes absolutely perfect sense. And the social media stuff, I mean, you can basically pick which version of the news you want to read, because it's all out there. 95% of it is nonsense, of course. Well, John, my final question for you. If you woke up tomorrow and discovered that you were responsible for the mental health of the world, what three things would you do?
Wow, that's a tough one. I think I'd devote a lot more financial resources to mental health, for a starter. That's always been chronically underfunded. We have nothing in the U.S. like IAPT, I think it's Improving Access to Psychological Treatments in the U.K., which has been an attempt to increase access to good care, evidence-based treatment. So I would take something out of the defense budgets to pay for mental well-being and prevention of mental disorders and effective treatments. That's probably the big one. Maybe this is more selfish, but I guess I would also want to increase clinical research funding. I don't think we've solved all the problems that we face in treating psychiatric problems. And prevention is wonderful if you can do that. Secondarily, if a disorder develops, you want to have all the best tools and a range of tools to treat them. And we have pretty good tools, but we have a lot of problems still we haven't solved. And I guess if I had to pick a third thing, it's really global, I would try to improve general social welfare, because a good basis for life is protective. If you have good nutrition and housing and education and general medical care, and I guess parent education wouldn't hurt, kids would grow up in much healthier circumstances, which might forestall a lot of mental health problems. How's that?
I think pretty much on target, John. If you run for that particular office, I'll be in the car driving around saying, vote for Professor Markowitz. John, I want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your perspectives. And importantly, for all you obviously do to help patients dealing with these very, very distressing conditions. As I say, until this entered my life 3 years ago, and then subsequently with other issues, it open my mind. So thank you very much, John.
Thank you so much for having me, John. As always, a pleasure.
Well, so COVID-19's, I guess, brought the importance of mental health into a very sharp focus, and perhaps done a lot to destigmatize this area. And those dealing with depression, anxiety, John mentioned celebrities, PTSD with the young men and women who've been involved in warfighter activities. And that these people can more readily access care with all the changes occurring in psychiatric care delivery. Well, that's it for this week on the EMG Health Podcast. But please tune in again next week and every Friday for more episodes with more inspiring guests. Be safe, be well, and stay curious. Bye for now.